Here we go. Okay, so what I'm going to we're going to do is we're going to I'm going to quickly present some pictures and images that I think, at least in my mind, create a model of how we put some of this science into operation. Okay, so I'm not going to go into a lot of detail these pictures. So think of it just kind of as an embellishment of what Barbara was saying. And picture, get an image now. Okay, so we're going to talk getting our arms around scale and assessment units very quickly. Multiple scales. Here we are at the regional scale. What happens at that scale? What kind of information comes down from that that helps us make decisions at the parcel scale, at the project scale? Okay, we can do things like that. Bill Ainslie is doing some of this right now. These are called synoptic assessments. It's essentially looking at big, large areas and doing a comparative risk assessment, breaking an area into watersheds or counties or whatever, and saying, okay, looking at where do I have a lot of wetlands at risk, where there are, I don't know, good wetlands, a number of wetlands, a lot of stressors, a lot of permit action. There's models that go on. People do this at state scale. Regional planners do this. But what this kind of scale tells you is that in this dark area, number two, I have something going on. It's maybe a little bit riskier site. There's a lot of wetland loss, a lot of good wetlands there to begin with. Something's going on. I might want to prioritize that area and go there and do some additional planning. If I happen to be a regulator and I see a map like that and I happen to be in a number two zone, why is that dark? It's dark in this case because of a high risk of biodiversity. Somebody said that there were a lot of wetlands that were at risk. They were very rich wetlands. They're going away. So if I'm working that area, I might want to think biodiversity. Some of these other colors might mean water quality. So that gives you a bit of some knowledge. See, I point it this way. We drop down scale. And thanks to Brad Johnson, who's been doing a lot of work in Colorado, we say, what happens at this scale? Okay, because right now we're talking about we work at multiple scales. So yes, that was the answer to the first question. And then when we get down there, what do we see when we drop down scales? More and more different types of assessment unit factors come in. In this one, we have Summit County. This is in Colorado. It looks like a watershed. This is good because Summit County happens to be a watershed. So we have a political unit. We're going to get a little simpler here. And that is a key fact. We can cheat. Sometimes it falls in our right. Usually you can have a political unit that covers one ecoregion, so we can sometimes cheat a little bit or fudge, but it makes some things simple. But in this case, I think Barbara made a very good point. Political units are where decisions are made. So we have to, I almost start with that. I like to say if we're going to do a watershed plan or something, we have to kind of consider what's the political unit. Often SAMHSA and ADIDS are named by the town they're in. If they're in Orange County or San Diego or what, LA County, some of the SAMHSA going on, Tooele in Utah, as it were. So they become very important. So sometimes I like to start at that political scale. That's where I'm going to have the decision-making hit the dirt. Now, within that, I might be fortunate that my political area is a watershed. That's good. Sometimes, as you'll see in this color, I come in different, these different colors represent different ecoregions or hydrogeologic settings. We're going to fudge those two names for the time being. So imagine I'm in political unit. I'm going to say, okay, I need to know what my ecoregions are within that political unit because I'm going to set benchmarks. If I want to know what my targets are, the targets in the green zones, there should be basically the same kind of benchmarks of targets across the green zone, okay? Same in the brown zone. So I need to know the ecoregions to know what the targets are, what my criteria is. And the criteria will be kind of all the same within those zones. So the ecoregions are very important. Why do I need to know the watershed? Well, as Barbara mentioned, water does flow downhill. So I want to know that because when I begin to do things, doing green things that should be done in the green zone, as it were, in this particular county of Summit, I want to evaluate down the road, am I having an effect? So somewhere down the road, I want to see in an adaptive management sort of way, am I having an effect? Water flows downhill. We do hydrologic modeling, so I need to do keep an active eye on that watershed because down the road, I'm going to do hydrologic modeling and see if I have an effect. So that's kind of an interplay between three different scales, as it were. Oops. I'll point at this. I don't know. Shoot, keep shooting. There. Okay. So that's, I think I answered the first two. The first question is scale, multiple scales. Okay. And what are the assessment units we have to keep in mind, or these factors that go into assessment, the three? Political units, watersheds, and political boundaries. We're going kind of faster. Now, what does the science begin to say? Reference is kind of one of those things, because if we're setting criteria, we want to know whether we're being successful or not. So one of the first things science says is like, oh, for each of these little zones that we're in, within a political unit, within a particular ecoregion, within this watershed. Now I've got myself oriented in space now, 3D as it were. When I make a decision, how do I know what I'm right or wrong? What's the reference? Okay, so this is the first thing. And let me show you a very quick and easy way of how we do reference that can be put operational. And in about one more slide, I'm going to show Molly. It's going to be done in not such a amount of effort. So here we are. We're in Summit County. And we have different colors. Those are the different ecoregions. The blue lines are watersheds. Well, what we begin to see, because of this neat new invention, shall we say, hydrogeomorphic approach to wetland classification, which is a functional classification system, by the way. We'll get into that a little bit later, is that I can say, okay, within one of these domains in the blue zone, I have a mix of wetlands. I have riverine, slope, depressional, fringe wetlands within that system. So what would be the reference for that system at the landscape scale? And there's going to be a position I got to stand back here. Is that this is the new kind of a breakthrough we have in deciding reference. For each of those, we can create a simple profile. So here's a watershed. We have riverine slope. And this is what we kind of have. Now, what's kind of neat is that when we begin to do compensatory mitigation, it's like, well, I'd rather not create or try to restore a wetland that's atypical from this profile. If this is what it is, I don't want to start making a lot of, say, fringe wetlands that this particular domain has in its nature, this particular profile. It's stick with the profile, as it were. So when we take a watershed, we can say, well, here's an example. Let me make this point because I'm going real fast here as far as profiles, and could be an EPA report coming out in the next few months talking about this stuff. But here we have two watersheds, a reference watershed. And I'm not sure. Say there's a reference watershed in there, which is minimally disturbed, fewer roads, not a lot of logging. Same ecoregion as a disturbed watershed, one that has a lot of roads and a lot of forest practices and stuff. And we begin to see that in a natural, relatively undisturbed watershed, which is the blue one, it becomes a reference profile. You see riverine, slope, a little depressional, maybe a fringe, certainly no irrigated meadow. In the impacted watershed, what's happening is we begin to see a shift from the reference where we're essentially stepping away from, let me see if this goes, oops, I gotta go back now, stepping away from what would be normally referenced. So the impacted watershed, we're beginning to pick up, oh, what are we ticking here? We're actually it's easier in the, this is depressional and impacted. We're losing in the impacted watersheds, the depressional one. So remember, the blue is the reference. So what's happening is we are, in impacted watersheds, losing a part of the profile. So the lesson here, very simply, is we can create, very simple, without looking in the details. So glaze your eye. Don't look at all the words, but this is a symbol of a checklist. And what this says is you go into a watershed, you can create a profile, you go to the NWI people, who for a fee, by the way, can give you a wetland profile of what that watershed is. This is the relative distribution and abundance of watersheds by HGM class. HGM class is important because each class provides a certain function. If I begin to degrade that profile, I'm actually degrading the functions that come with the wetlands in that particular watershed. So what I got to do is maintain the profile, and when an applicant comes in using a checklist like that, it's like, okay, folks, what is the profile of wetlands? What are the typical distribution of wetlands by class in your watersheds that you're working in? Okay, go figure that out. And then come back and say, I'm now going to be replacing an HGM wetland in the right HGM spot pursuant to the profile. So you get a logic flow that begins to go like that. And again, the Oregon Division of State Lands is doing that. It's in their rule now. You have to kind of begin to describe what is the HGM class you're putting back in the right HGM place. That's a little bit different story than we've seen in the past. Now, let me get into another level. So that's, you're done. So you can have that dialogue with an applicant, right? You can just do that. What's the HGM class? We're not saying what functions are you getting back in wetland. No, give me back a wetland that's consistent with the profile, okay? Just do that and give me narrative that says I'm going to do that. And then I can make a best professional judgment whether you're doing it or not. Because I have these profiles, I can look at them. Okay, let's now drop scale and say, let's say I want to do a little bit more than just that. Again, the science is kind of saying something else too. So still we're sticking with the reference idea a little bit. But it says that we traditionally looked at wetlands. I think Barbara was mentioning individual wetlands. We have these little green splotches and they're little gems scattered across the landscape. And we've tended to in the past go, I'm going to stand in this wetland and evaluate its functions. And we'll go over here and evaluate its functions, as it were. And you know, what's kind of interesting is in many cases, I think we're not really evaluating the functions of this individual wetland. This is where Dan's going to get a little... And the functions is, I think we're actually looking at whether this wetland's hammered or not and the condition of this wetland versus this. And this probably is a new way of thinking, because here we have... Barbara said this too. Wetlands aren't... They're part of this mosaic. And so what it really comes down to is what Siobhan and Mary Cantula, a bunch of more and more people are saying, is that do we really, when we're trying to figure out what's happening, what is the reference, what is this wetland going to be, and how am I going to make a decision on it? We've been looking at the function. Maybe we should begin to evaluate its condition, whether it's healthy or not. And if I can make some, I'm going to lead to a point here. If I can figure out what this condition is, maybe I can make some better decisions, as it were. So let's now go on and see how I would take that. So I'm going to, and I can go out to, by the way, hang in with me there. There's a couple more slides, and it'll make all sense. Is I can go out to individual wetlands. This is the new innovation, because we're going from function to condition. We're going to individual wetlands, evaluate the condition, and I can say whether they're hammered or not. Okay? And I can use a rapid assessment form. I could do that. This is somebody else's slides, John Max. I can make sure that that rapid assessment form, the way that I use, go out to the site, because I don't have much time to make an assessment. I'm going to evaluate the condition of that well. I'm going to do it real fast because I've done work in the same ecoregion, as it were, using more intensive methods instead using IBIs or hydrogeomorphic assessment methodologies. I think this rapid assessment works. That allows me then, hold on, to go to different individual wetlands and give them kind of a rating, give them kind of how healthy they are or not. Thank you, Josh, for this particular slide. Okay. So what do we do? How do we put, what is the science saying? We have used reference information to make decisions about individual projects, about their condition. I'm going to take that information and I'm going to put it in a watershed context. Okay. So here we go. We're going to use Blackberry Creek as an example. Let's see if I can do this. And the key to pulling this off is saying, Where do I restore? I know I want to do this profile. I want to put the right wetland in the right place. How do I begin to do that? And Barbara went through this story about, you know, there's complexities. Look how these watersheds are all working, and they're all kind of different. And how, as a regulator, am I supposed to really know where to go? And the key that turns this whole machine on is something comes out of biodiversity and says, save the best. Go to the best places. Go to those gems. And see if you can make them a little bit bigger and see if you can create some more gems. So you have to go find the gems at the watershed scale. And you do this by using a rapid assessment method within a watershed and you begin to try to find them. You put them on the map, okay? And you begin to try to then take those individual pearls that we just found. We try to create a simple model that links them together into form a pattern. And then the idea is, are we doing the right hydrogeomorphic thing? Are we putting the right HGM class wetland in the right place? So right now we're talking about how to find the right place. And the right place to begin with is to look for where there's already something already kind of relatively intact. A really good piece of wetland that exists, and we're going to just make it better. We're going to just kind of grow it out along corridors and patches. And if we can eventually make a decision that says, are we doing the right thing? HGM class in the right place for this map, then we're probably making some progress. So this is how we then create that within that watershed, that particular map that says we're in the right place. Because location, 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 where'd you go, is what we're supposed to do. So let's find how we're going to do the location. We begin by saying, let's see here what happens next. Okay, we have a layer of where the streams are. Remember, we're trying to find where to put these things. These are the connecting pieces, the processes. So we always talk about processes, right? And so what we're going to do is we're going to say, where are the processes in the landscape? Where are our gems relative to the streams? Where are they relative to the floodplain? These are how we connect the dots of the wetland. Where is it? Where are wetlands? Where are the connections? We begin to see that a green infrastructure forms. Okay, we're growing out from our points into the area. We then begin to say, oh, I think I have a bit. I'm going to go back here for a second. We then say, back up, goes good. We then have the beginnings of where we go. We want to put the right HGM class wetland in the right HGM kind of place. This gives us some clues. It gives us the first approximation of where we go. Okay? So here we go. Another slide. How do we create these little maps? Well, under the hood, there's something called conceptual models, which Bill Ainslie has worked on for years and stuff others. So essentially, we look at this and like, how do we combine? Well, I want to have proximity to the stream. I want to have the right hydric soils. I want to have so forth and so forth. And you get this little model like this. It basically tells you how to take your GIS layers and connect them together. Now, in this case, way down here, oh, proximity to a relatively intact natural wetland. This is where you would do, remember, trying to bring it back around. We were out there wandering the watershed with our rapid assessment method, figuring out where the gems are. Okay, that's our ADID map. That's our SAMP map. That's whatever, it, you know, that's where we've identified it. We've combined the other layers, and out comes essentially a restoration map that looks like this. Now, here comes the final part. Oh, question number four. This is getting hard. Okay, what are their landscape considerations? So the sciences, we've got to do reference. Sciences, we've got to think of it in terms of cumulative effects. The last point is landscape considerations. It's the key consideration, and Barbara kind of went on, about the hydrogeologic setting. Very, very important. Then there's this other thing that kind of trumps a lot of that. It's called human disturbance. It's like land use. It's like, well, you have the water coming here. You have the water coming here. You have the jet airliner landing over here. I mean, it's just it's a matter of scale. So we have to embed that little green infrastructure within an existing land use land cover map. And this is what we begin to do, putting wetlands in a watershed context. Let me see what happens next, the next slide here. Oops, yeah, let's go back. We don't want to do that yet. So the point here is that in a map like this, when you're all done, at one level you're going to be saying as a regular, I suspect, and I've been in one for about 12 years before I did this job, is that I want to put the right HGM class in the right place. Applicant, tell me. What HGM class you're building? Where are you going to put it? Why does it make sense in a hydrogeomorphic setting? Here's some checklists. Do the right thing in the right place. Oh, by the way, if you happen to have a plan like this, which they do in Eugene, places that have been prioritized, and they are coming up in Sampson, all over San Francisco Bay, you guys got lots of maps like this, is that you begin to say, okay, put your wetland, your HGM class, somewhere in the green zone, because we spent a lot of time making that picture appear. Okay? And that's how you begin to do it, step by step. Now, if you really want to get fancy, and we're going to end here pretty quick, is that there are things called templates. And you can say, okay, well, if I were to take that little map I just had and just did the old conventional way and just put my little HGM wetland in the right place but didn't buffer it, that's that template. Some cases here I'm trying to grow the wetland a little bit more versus the principles I just mentioned. We have surrounding our wetlands, we have conventional and conservation-based. So I have houses around it there that are just large lot, poor design in terms of stormwater management. I have around my mitigation wetlands and restored wetlands something a little more innovative in its design and managing stormwater as it were. I can actually populate that entire map with these little templates and essentially kind of come up with a little coefficient of what, how much water they produce and are retained on the site. Do little models that tell me if I do conservation things in the right way and I build my wetlands and put them in the right place, I can model that watershed and say, yes, indeed, and I won't go into detail. Trust me, this just says if you do the right thing in the right place, you get good environmental results. Okay? That's what this says. Okay? In terms of all types of hydrologic indicators, as it were. And by the way, Sue and I just got in some reports that said, and it doesn't cost that much to actually do it the right way. Okay, so this is knowing, can you do wetlands in a watershed context, in a planning context? You can actually model it and begin to predict and forecast for people that it's actually not only going to work in terms of environmental benefits, but the costs aren't going to be too much. Okay, and I think that's how you kind of do it. You kind of do this Sam Edith thing with an alternative futures kind of thing, and that's how you do compensatory mitigation in a larger context. So there you go. I think so. That's how you do it.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah.